True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
New Jersey mom Michelle Nice spent the last night of her life working the makeup counter at Macy's, followed by a romantic tryst with her lover. When she finally did arrive home, her husband was waiting for her in a jealous rage. Michelle had come all the way from the Philippines when she was just 20 years old to be the wife of 41-year-old Dr. Jonathan Nice. After 15 years of marriage, they were raising three children together in their luxurious $1.6 million home. But Jonathan, the former chief executive of a pharmaceutical company, was failing in his career and in his marriage. He was about to lose everything, and that includes Michelle. Join us at the quiet end for Mail Order Murder, the story of Michelle and Jonathan Nice. Michelle and Jonathan were an unlikely couple, but they did seem to make things work for a time. By 2004, though, their relationship was strained and Michelle had fallen in love with their former gardener. So was Jonathan capable of killing his pretty young wife? Or was her lover responsible for her death? We're going to talk about it and find out.
Yes, we will. So I have a nice New Jersey beer for today. We've had a few cases from New Jersey and I've reviewed a lot of carton beers and cane beers. This time I'm going to do Magnify Brewing Company and their Imperial IPA. It's called Peak Oil, 9% alcohol by volume. It's a cloudy orange, maybe kind of orangey gold color, small head. Aroma has citrus and tropical fruit. Taste is even nicer, pineapple, mango, and a little bit of orange. Got a nice hoppy finish. It's a little bitter. Pretty stellar beer.
It sounds really good. So it's in a can, huh?
Yep.
All right. Well, then let's open up a couple of those.
Yeah, we can do a couple. One each.
Yes. Yes.
Since we're the only denizens of the quiet end right now.
Yes.
Well, we got some dogs hanging around too, but they don't count.
They don't get beer.
And I'm not sharing my beer with them.
Although one of them kind of likes beer, but we're not going to give it to him.
Nope.
Okay. Well, come sit over here and you can start out our story about Michelle and Jonathan. It's quite a story. Starts out pretty happy and then things do go awry pretty quickly.
Well, it looks almost to me like it was kind of doomed from the start, from the first meeting that they had.
Well, there were lies right off, that's never good. Yeah.
So let's get started. Michelle Nice was born Michele Riviera on November 18th, 1969. She was the fourth child of Trefisa and Teodoro Riviera. They had seven kids in all. And she grew up in a tiny village just outside the Manila Bay port of Arayan, which is a three-hour ferry ride from Manila. Now, her father, Teodoro, always struggled to make ends meet, trying to feed his large family. And even when she was a young child, Michelle always stood out for her intelligence and beauty. From a young age, she knew that it was important for her to do well in school if she wanted a better life for herself. In addition to her schoolwork, though, she also helped care for her younger siblings. She cooked, she cleaned the house, did a lot. When she was 16, Michelle moved to Quezon City and enrolled in the National College of Business Administration. But after just one semester, she had to drop out because her parents couldn't afford the tuition. She didn't want to return home, so she found a job on the former Subic Bay U.S. Naval Base near Olongapo City. She lived with her aunt and also took a job in a dress store, worked on learning her English.
Yeah, so strong work ethic.
Very.
Before the Subic Bay base closed in the early 1990s, it had been notorious for prostitution, with an estimated 17,000 teen girls being used as sex workers for the off-duty U.S. servicemen. There's no evidence of Michelle ever being involved in prostitution, but she still wanted to hide that she'd lived there. because just to say she'd lived there could lead to some assumptions that she really wanted to avoid. It was during her years there that Michelle had her first interactions with affluent Americans and the American lifestyle. It was something that she wanted for herself one day, and at 18, she joined a pen pal agency, which guaranteed to find their clients male friends in the United States. She already knew some English, enough to write her own letters. So I would dare say that this was a way to try and find an American husband, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No, well, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, as long as everything's presented honestly.
Exactly. Which it wasn't always.
No. Some background on Jonathan Nice, who became her husband. He was born on May 26, 1950, in Lansdale, Pennsylvania. He is the first of four sons. 2 years after Jonathan, David was born, followed by Michael in 1955, and their youngest son, Richard, was born in 1957. Money was pretty scarce in the Nice house, and they often had a tough time making ends meet on his father's wages as a stocking maker. When Jonathan was four, the family moved to Gettysburg, and his father found a better-paying job in a mill.
Yeah, but as a child, Jonathan was a loner. He had difficulty making friends, and he was a serious, quiet boy who mostly lived in his own world. But he did have an imagination, and he loved to write stories and poetry. As a young child, Jonathan was fascinated by science, and he was always doing experiments of one kind or another. He dreamed of becoming a medical doctor. In 1957, the Nice family settled down in a large house in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. And growing up, Jonathan and his brother Michael both had some pretty bad asthma, serious enough to prevent Jonathan from participating in some activities. And whenever he had a mild respiratory illness, his life was actually at risk.
Yeah, you can get pretty sick if you have underlying asthma.
Yes. But as a teen, Jonathan was tall and thin, and that earned him the nickname Beanpole. He was smart, but he was quiet, and he did excel in math and science. And even though he was good-looking enough, he didn't really have any girlfriends, probably because he was so shy.
He went to Temple University in Philadelphia in 1968. Now, it took him 8 years to get his bachelor's degree. Then, 2 years later, he got his master's, and in 1983, he has a doctorate. Then he did some postdoctoral work in Los Angeles, and when he completed that, he got a job at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. And over time, he eventually got to a full professor status in 1988.
When Michelle received her first letter from Jonathan Nice, it was the summer of 1989, and she was excited. Not only did he describe himself as a wealthy and successful scientist and professor, but his photo showed that he was a tall, young, and handsome blonde, very attractive and very American-looking, and this appealed to her. So Michelle answered Jonathan's letters immediately, telling him all about her life and her dreams. She sent him a photo of herself, too. And over those next several months, they began a romantic relationship with weekly exchanges of cards, letters, and even graduating to phone calls. In October of 1989, Jonathan sent Michelle a postcard from Columbia, South Carolina, telling her about his romantic feelings for her and his intention of meeting her in person. Then in May of 1990, he surprised her by announcing that he'd bought a plane ticket to the Philippines so that they could get married.
Now, I know they've been talking or sort of dating, letter writing, whatever they were doing, for about a year. But that's kind of quick, and they hadn't even met. So I'm flying to the Philippines and get ready. I'm going to marry you.
Yeah, I would think you should have a couple in-person meetings before you decide to get married.
Certainly.
But he was in a hurry, and they seemed like they were really into one another. Yeah. You know, and aside from being attracted, she needed some stability and maybe a little more money, and he needed a wife, and she was super cute. So, well, I don't know. As long as they're both happy with it,
sure.
I don't judge it.
Well, Jonathan had a joint meeting to attend of the American and Japanese Cancer Societies in Hawaii. And after that meeting, he was invited to give a lecture at the National Cancer Center in Tokyo. The Philippines visit would be in between the two meetings. So Michelle told her family the news, explaining that she had an understanding with this young American professor. But her father wanted to know more about his future son-in-law before he'd allow his daughter to marry him. So he consulted a friend who advised him to make sure his daughter's American boyfriend had a legal capacity to contract marriage certificate, which was required by the Philippine government before a U.S. citizen can wed a Filipino national. So Michelle asked Jonathan about the document, and he assured her he would take care of everything through the American embassy. So in early June of 1990, Teodoro Rivera chaperoned his pretty 20-year-old daughter on the ferry to Manila.
So during this three-hour journey, Michelle was very nervous. She worried if she was making a mistake. But her father told her not to worry. She could always call off the marriage if she decided she didn't like him in person. But when they arrived at Jonathan's hotel, she got her first look at her husband-to-be. And at first she was pretty shocked, and she thought there had to be a mistake. There was this pudgy, red-faced man with thinning blonde hair, and he looked twice her age, which he was. And when he wrote to Michelle, he had included this very flattering picture of himself, probably from 20 years ago. He didn't look anything like that anymore. But for 2 days, Jonathan, Michelle, and her dad stayed at the hotel, and they filled out paperwork for the American Service Branch of the U.S. Embassy in Manila. Jonathan and Michelle spent their first nights together, sleeping in his hotel suite, while her dad stayed in another room across the hall. So it seems like it's going to move forward at that point.
Boy, it sure does.
And after the initial shock of Jonathan's appearance, Michelle did seem to warm up to him. She said that she was in love with him, and they seemed to love spending time together. 2 days after he had arrived in Manila, her father gave his consent to the marriage, and the three of them traveled back across Manila Bay to apply for a marriage license at Orion Municipal Building.
So when Jonathan arrived at the Riviera family home, his future mother-in-law and Michelle's siblings were waiting to welcome him. He was pretty emotional as he hugged and kissed his new family. Turns out family had always been important to Jonathan, and he seemed happy to finally meet his future in-laws. He immediately gave the family some American dollars to have a wedding dress made for Michelle. But as the happy bridegroom showered his bride and her family with gifts, she began to get cold feet. She was afraid and wondered if she was doing the right thing. But still, she went ahead with their plans. On June 11, 1990, just 1 week after they first met, Jonathan married Michelle in a civil ceremony at the office of the local civil registrar in Orion. Michelle was more beautiful than ever, and they were surrounded by her excited family members.
So it's interesting, though, that before the wedding, Jonathan, who at this point is 41, had altered his birth certificate, taking 8 years off of his age. And this was really shabbily done with whiteout that was visible under a retyped number 8, because he'd put an 8 over the 0, changing his date of birth from 1950 to 1958. So his official Filipino wedding certificate stated that he was born on May 26, 1958, which would have made him just 32 years old. And the amazing thing is that Jonathan kept up this lie of being 8 years younger than he really was for the first 10 years of his marriage to Michelle. And you can imagine when she finds out the truth, she's not happy.
I'll bet she wasn't. You know, she first meets him, he's not what he portrayed himself as. And then as she goes along, she's getting more nervous about going ahead and doing this. Should have not done it.
Well, let's be honest here. I think she was in a rough spot. She was living in poverty. I don't know how severe the poverty was, but definitely in poverty, with a large family in a small home. And she wanted to do more with her life. So this was kind of an easier way for her to be successful and get out of there and into the U.S. where she wanted to be.
Yeah.
So it's kind of sad that way that she felt she needed to use her looks and
it is
her body.
Yes, it is.
But it's reality for a lot of people.
Yeah, I suppose. And I guess what she could do is say, once I get to the U.S. and get acclimated, I can dump this guy.
Well, but she didn't do that.
No, she didn't.
So she must have had some feelings.
Well, I don't know. She probably liked the money.
Well, of course. There was a lot of money.
Yeah.
But the newlyweds spent the first week of their marriage in a local hotel room, getting to know each other. They spent their days on the beach and their evenings having candlelit dinners. And Jonathan was very generous, kind to her, and showed her a lot of respect. Michelle's family really liked him, and Michelle believed that her dreams had come true. In the United States, Jonathan opened a bank account for Michelle, and he also gave money to her father. Michelle had to remain in the Philippines to apply for an American visa before she could join her husband in North Carolina. That's where they planned to live. And after Jonathan and Michelle said goodbye at the Manila airport, he flew home and continued his life as if nothing had changed. And when I say that, I mean it. He didn't tell anyone that he had gotten married, not even his parents or siblings. He explained his absence at work to his fellow colleagues by claiming that he had attended a cancer conference in Hawaii. He didn't mention his trip to the Philippines at all.
This is just getting weirder, Jill.
Well, we like our stories weird.
This one is.
Yes.
So after Jonathan ran back to the United States, he and Michelle were in daily contact, planning for their new life together in North Carolina. Jonathan took care of Michelle and her family. He opened a bank account for them, and he mailed monthly checks to help them improve their lives. He even took an evening job to earn extra money. By the winter, after their marriage, though, Michelle's visa had still not yet been granted by the U.S. Immigration Service, and Jonathan was getting increasingly frustrated that Michelle had not yet joined him.
Yeah, but in my eyes, if she wasn't really into him, she had a good deal there. She got to stay home and have the financial benefits of being married to him for her and her family. But for the sake of argument, I'm going to assume that she did care about him at that point.
Okay. Since the marriage, Jonathan had developed a kind of a big brother-like relationship with Michelle's 12-year-old sister, Melodia, and frequently offered her his guidance. He told Melodia how both he and Michelle were upset that the U.S. government was taking so long to approve the visa. 3 months later, Michelle's visa had still not come through, and Jonathan was getting more and more nervous. So he began calling Michelle daily, and he sent her piles of romantic cards and letters. So
yeah.
He's probably thinking, okay, they're stonewalling me. She doesn't really want to come, and they're using his visa stuff as an excuse.
I think you're right on target there, yeah. And maybe she wasn't in a big hurry to come. But in late March, her visa did finally come through, and Jonathan immediately booked her a one-way plane ticket to California. He was super excited. And they planned to have a short vacation there before he brought her back to Greenville, North Carolina. In April 1991, Michelle said goodbye to her family and flew to California, where Jonathan joined her, and it was a happy reunion. Before he'd left Greenville, he'd prepared for her sudden arrival as his wife. But embarrassed for anyone to know that he had married a Filipino mail-order bride, he made up a cover story to explain how they'd met. And he stuck to this story for years, just like he did with the age lie. He explained to Michelle that she should tell everyone that they had met in Hawaii while he'd been attending the medical conference there, that he had tripped over her foot while they were on a scuba diving excursion, and that it had been love at first sight. And Michelle was okay with this too, because remember, she didn't want to be seen as a prostitute or even a mail order bride. I mean, neither one of those makes you feel very good about yourself.
No, and it's kind of a cute meeting story, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't know. It just makes me question his character when you're making up stories like that right off the bat.
Well, he's been doing that from day one with
her. Yeah, you're right.
So when they did finally arrive in Greenville, North Carolina, Jonathan proudly introduced his new bride to his family and colleagues. And they were certainly all taken off guard by the news. There was much speculation about the Hawaii story, with many people wondering how long Jonathan had planned to marry this much younger Filipino woman. But Michelle soon won over the faculty members and their wives, who liked her fun and spontaneous personality. She had a thick Filipino accent, but she worked hard, really hard, at improving her English.
Yeah, she was a bright young woman from everything I've read. When Jonathan took her to meet his parents, their new daughter-in-law was a complete surprise to them. But they liked her. They accepted her. She really seemed to make their son happy. Before Michelle had arrived, Jonathan had rented an off-campus apartment in Greenville for them to live in, and within a few months, Michelle became pregnant. Jonathan was thrilled by the prospect of becoming a father, too. In January of 1992, Michelle gave birth to a baby boy, and they named him Alex. And Jonathan was right there helping with the delivery and cutting the umbilical cord. And Alex was a healthy baby. Jonathan loved showing off Michelle and his new son to the other professors and their families at their regular faculty social events. And Jonathan doted on the little boy. He spent as much time as he could playing with him, and Michelle, who was at this point 22 years old, was very happy to be a mom. She sent her parents photos of their new grandson, promising that they would meet him in person in the near future. Then, in early 1993, Michelle was pregnant again. On November 8th, she gave birth to another son, and they named this one Trevor. And once again, Jonathan was a very devoted father, spending as much time with his family as he could manage. He was working long days with Dr. James Metzger, perfecting an asthma drug, but he still found time to see Michelle and his sons every evening. During his lunch breaks, Michelle and the boys often met Jonathan by a duck pond near his work so they could have more family time together as well.
Then in the spring of 1995, Jonathan took a leave of absence from East Carolina University. He started up a company called Epigenesis Pharmaceuticals. Now, after years of research, Jonathan claimed that his new asthma drug, tentatively named Epi 2010, had passed early animal trials with no adverse reactions. One early article about the company and an ECU publication created a lot of excitement in the North Carolina medical establishment. The article had a picture of Jonathan with his arms crossed, standing with his research partner, Dr. W. James Metzger. The article explained how Dr. Nice and his team of researchers at the ECU School of Medicine had discovered a drug that could prevent asthma attacks. And Dr. Metzger was quoted as saying he believed Epi 2010 would help nearly all asthmatics, however serious their condition. The drug was being developed in partnership with ECU under a licensing agreement with Epigenesis, which was a university company, and that retained the patent as well as financial interest in the new company. So Jonathan's not getting anything out of this, is he? The university owns it.
Well, with him, and he gets a lot of people to donate, so he does very well financially, actually.
Okay.
But he claimed his new company already had a 5-year, $5 million venture capital agreement with an unnamed investment banking firm, as well as peer-reviewed awards from the National Institutes of Health and the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. He was rarely in the laboratory at the school, and he got a lot of attention and was generally a very good spokesman for his company, although people would note that he embellished the truth whenever he felt it was necessary, and he had no qualms with that, which we already know in his personal life he's been dishonest.
We do.
One day, in the middle of an Epigenesis presentation, he had an uncontrollable fit of coughing, and he was actually struggling for breath. Remember, he himself had asthma, and he used the episode to his advantage as if he was demonstrating how horrible asthma can be. And he told the meeting participants that nearly 7,000 people die from the disease every year. A lot of them are children, too.
Right. It's not a great disease to have.
No, it's very serious.
So in 1997, Jonathan Nice co-wrote a paper titled DNA Antisense Therapy for Asthma in an Animal Model. Now, the concept behind the clinical trial was that traditional treatments attack symptoms of asthma and steroids only temporarily calm the constricted bronchial tubes. Nice claimed that antisense molecules could stop the gene that produced a protein that causes the underlying problems in asthma patients.
So I don't know if it just didn't work out or if he was lying a lot. I kind of have a feeling that he was making stuff up.
Yeah, he could be scamming them a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. In 1998, Nice moved his company to a 5,100-square-foot building, and the business had investors, and drug trials seemed promising. Those working with Nice saw him as a really driven man who worked hard and was always calm and optimistic. so by late 2000 he was preparing for trials of EPI 2010 in London. By this time, Jonathan and Michelle had their third child, a daughter named Samantha. They lived in a big new house in Hopewell, New Jersey. The property was located on a former horse farm, so there were very few trees. So in 2001, Jonathan contacted Ostrich Nursery. Gardener Alexander Castaneda came to look at the property and make a project plan. Since Michelle was the one mainly at home, she's the one who spoke with him several times. And they ended up exchanging cell phone numbers. So Castaneda was actually a 31-year-old Puerto Rican named Miguel de Jesus, also known by the nickname Enyo. He and a crew of gardeners planted about $50,000 worth of saplings and other shrubs.
That's some pretty good landscaping.
Isn't that expensive? That's a lot of trees.
I think they were sparing no expense.
No, they didn't. After they finished, De Jesus was the one who knocked on the front door and gave the bill to Michelle Nice. There was a mutual attraction between this rich young mom of three and this friendly gardener, but it took several months before they would meet again.
Then in the spring of 2002, Jonathan Nice had to start laying off some of his staff, and he cut the number of his employees down to a dozen, because things weren't going well. Company's finances were not good. They had spent an estimated $40 million of venture capital with basically no results. So the company's running out of money. And as time went on, there was more and more pressure on Jonathan Nice to keep his company going. He urgently needed money to pay for his clinical trials. So this situation was desperate, and he ended up taking out a $200,000 home equity loan. But nothing was going to fix the steady flow of funds, monies being lost.
Sure, and as we know, a great deal of stress can really cause marriage problems as well. And the trouble in the Nice marriage was becoming kind of obvious. Michelle's sister, Melodia, said that her sister was thinking of leaving her husband at this point. And when their father came to live with them that summer, from the Philippines, he saw the marriage falling apart. Jonathan was drinking to excess, and the couple were just fighting every day. Verbal fights, but they could get very cruel, name-calling, and the kind of fighting you should not do, ever. Around this time, Jonathan and Michelle were at a family birthday party for his brother Michael, and Michelle was talking to her mother-in-law when Jonathan's birthday came up in the conversation. Jonathan's mom, Emma Nice, happened to mention that Jonathan had been born in 1950, and Michelle said, "Well, you must be mistaken, that would make him 52, and he's only 44. But Emma insisted, "Well, I'm right. I should know my son's age better than anyone, right? I gave birth to him." So this was a shock for Michelle to learn that her husband and the father of her kids had lied about his age from the very beginning, even on their wedding license. So she really resented this. I mean, the marriage wasn't in the best place at this point, and this was just another straw on the camel's back.
So and after learning about the lie with his age, Michelle seemed to make up her mind to get out of the marriage. But Jonathan controlled all the money, so she's feeling trapped. Jill, what did you put in the blender?
My Bluetooth earbuds. If I hear another piece of shit commercial, I'm going to scream.
That's a little extreme, don't you think? I can't help you with other podcasts, but all of our True Crime Brewery episodes now come with commercial-free versions for our Tie Grabber subscribers.
Well, I know. My hate for ads is what motivated me to give Tie Grabber members that ad-free option. If you subscribe at tiegrabber.com, you get to listen to all of our new episodes commercial-free, and this is in addition to our bonus episodes every month. Plus, you get some great TCB swag mailed to you when you join.
Okay, I get it. At least TCB listeners can avoid ads. Just turn off the damn blender. You're going to wake up the whole neighborhood.
Okay, I'm sorry for swearing.
Not a fucking problem. Now, there are some ways in which De Jesus helped Michelle feel liberated, except she wasn't aware that he had used at least three different names and Social Security numbers. So he's a bit of a scumbag also.
Yeah, absolutely. Not a great guy.
So even though De Jesus was a bit of a ladies' man, he was not particularly attractive.
No, not really.
He was short and stocky, with hair turning gray. He lived in the United States for 14 years, and he worked for the landscaping company the last five. Patricia was his common-law wife, and they had two daughters. But he was a deadbeat dad, and actually there was a warrant out for his arrest for non-payment of child support. He also owed support money for another daughter with a different woman. Now, he was using a different name to evade that warrant. Michelle liked to buy De Jesus expensive gifts, and he liked to tell her how beautiful she was.
Yeah, so who can resist that?
Exactly.
She was really wanting attention anyway. On January 15th of 2003, a friend of Michelle's had a strong premonition that something had happened to Michelle. And she said to her niece, "Jonathan has done something. He's the type of man who would snap." So she tried to reach Michelle, but her calls went unanswered. Then a New Jersey friend went to check up on Michelle and make sure she was okay. And Michelle was okay. She answered the door, but she just didn't seem like the old Michelle. She was standoffish and seemed really uncomfortable when she opened the door to someone who'd been a good friend. She refused to share her home number, which was weird, but she shared her cell number, and she reluctantly gave her friend a tour of this really big house. For the most part, showing off her home gym that was filled with expensive machines. And that seemed, other than her children, that's what she spent her time doing, was working out and keeping herself beautiful. The tour seemed to be a way to take attention away from herself and put it on the house, though. And when asked about Jonathan, she got very evasive and even nervous. But she said he was working a lot and they were just getting along fine. But this was the last time Michelle's friend ever saw her. And over the next several months, she tried Michelle's cell phone and left messages, but Michelle never called her back. So we know a lot of people, when things aren't going well, they kind of disconnect from their friends and family, and it seems like that was kind of what she was doing here.
Then in February of 2003, Michelle did get to visit her family in the Philippines. Jonathan was supposed to join her there, but he refused to let the kids go. So his parents agreed to move into their house and watch the kids so Jonathan could go. And it was his first trip to the Philippines since their marriage, since their wedding. Her family threw a party to celebrate. And everything seemed pretty good at first, but after a few days, Jonathan and Michelle began to fight all the time. And Jonathan was drinking a lot, too. In fact, one day over lunch, Jonathan decided that a handsome young tour guide was paying far too much attention to Michelle. So how's he handle this? He screams at her in front of the whole restaurant that was full of people.
Yeah, how humiliating.
Yep.
So a group of investors were beginning negotiations to take over the company from Jonathan Nice. So he was under quite a bit of pressure. It was becoming clear at this point that he would not be kept on as the CEO. So in March of 2003, he left Epigenesis, the company he had founded. The trials had been disappointing and the drug was shelved. But despite this financial disaster befalling him, Nice continued to spend like a rich guy. Even though their mortgage payments were over $6,000, which to me is unimaginable, he took his family on a trip to North Carolina and he purchased a Hummer for $50,000. He self-published a children's book, and then he started talking about starting a new company.
Yeah, but after he lost Epigenesis, Nice was in a deep depression. He tried to put a positive spin on things, but he still refused to talk about what had happened with anyone, including Michelle. He did announce that he was taking a sabbatical to work on a new cancer drug, but he told people he was being paid by Epigenesis for 2 years with full benefits. That was a lie. And then in his children's book, Dr. Nice's poems for children and the parents who love them, Jonathan used his children as characters. He hired a professional illustrator. And the first poem in it was based on a true story about how his sons had once used a piece of deer hide to make him a shoe for a Father's Day gift.
Yeah, but he also worked on creating a new company he called Prism Pharmaceuticals. And he claimed to be working on a drug to prevent lung cancer in smokers. But you know, he was home all day most days, and this did make it difficult for Michelle to sneak off and see her lover. When she did meet with DeJesus, she told Jonathan that she was going shopping or out to dinner with friends. She'd enrolled in a night class at the local community college to get licensed as a physical fitness instructor. But she told Jonathan that the class began over a month earlier than it actually did, in order to give her excuses for nights out with her lover. But Jonathan would figure this out and, of course, not be happy at all.
Then on June 26th, Michelle met with DeJesus. They went shopping, had some lunch, and then spent 2 hours in a motel room. And a couple days later, DeJesus' common-law wife found a pair of women's underwear in his coat pocket, and she promptly kicked him out of their apartment. Then on July 10th, according to the Hopewell Police Department, Jonathan Nice reported that he had received two calls from a man who wanted $500,000 in exchange for video and audio tapes of his wife having sex with another man. The man played the audio tapes for Nice and said that the tapes would be sold if the money was not paid. The calls were traced to a gas station in nearby Lawrenceville, and DeJesus denied making the calls.
Well, Jonathan did somehow manage to get DeJesus' phone number, and that July 23rd, he called him and told him to stay away from his wife and family. DeJesus denied the affair and just hung up on him. The next day, Michelle told the Hopewell Police Department that her affair with DeJesus lasted from October of 2002 until the demands for money were made on July 10th. She said that DeJesus had been taking an interest in her finances and had asked to borrow some money. And also, according to Michelle, he had been pressuring her to leave her husband. Jonathan thought he was trying to win his wife back, but his behavior was really very controlling and had the opposite effect. He bought her several expensive gifts, but then he closed their joint bank account so she wouldn't have access to any money, and he made her survive on a $300 per month allowance. So she couldn't send money back to her parents anymore, and that was a problem. It really helped them. But money was a problem back in the U.S. as well. Gas and electric bills were piling up, but Jonathan was continuing to spend, almost like an obsessive shopper. According to his parents, he leased a $52,000 Hummer, but they said that Michelle insisted on it, which doesn't really check out because Michelle never used that Hummer. She told one friend she didn't have enough money to put gas in it. They used a lot of gas.
Yes, they do.
And once they're...
Although there's a new electric one out.
Is there?
Yes.
Well, that's better. I'm sure it's still expensive.
But this Hummer stuff, I mean, who bought the Hummer first before the leased Hummer? Jonathan had.
He was the one driving the Hummers.
Yeah.
She actually had an older car. Well...
Probably buying gas for it would use up her whole $300 monthly allowance.
Yeah, pretty quickly. Once their daughter Samantha turned 5 years old and started kindergarten, Michelle had some more free time, and she took a part-time job as a beauty advisor at the cosmetics counter at Macy's. She worked about 25 hours a week for $9.25 an hour. But for her, it was just a relief to get out of the house for a few hours and have a little bit of her own money. Jonathan was at home all the time, and she was really feeling smothered by him. And at Macy's, Michelle made a friend. Her name was Amy. She was a 21-year-old Filipino girl who worked at the same counter. And the two confided a lot in each other. Michelle told Amy about her lover and that Jonathan had found out about the affair. And Amy confided in Michelle that she just found out she was pregnant by a married man who had abandoned her. So that's a shitty situation.
I guess.
Michelle also told Amy that she and Jonathan had been fighting really often for about 5 years now. The fights were all verbal, but she was upset that the children were being exposed to these fights. She said she wanted to get a divorce, but didn't have the money for an attorney. Amy told her she should work on her marriage and not risk losing custody of her children in a custody battle. I mean, to Amy, Michelle's life looked pretty good, because Amy's having a really hard time.
Yeah, she's
in a bad spot. Yeah.
So on August 19th, Jonathan Nice sent a fax to a detective, marked urgent, and it stated that Michelle said her lover was encouraging her to kill her husband. Now, the detective looked at these statements and thought they were outrageous. Michelle had never told the police that her lover wanted her to hurt her husband. The detective didn't believe that the facts was real. So, and it was decided that the allegations of extortion were unfounded.
Yeah.
Things are getting messy here.
It is messy. It's a messy situation. Jonathan went to court, and he was granted a 2-year restraining order on DeJesus, keeping him from contacting any members of the Nice family. But, you know, his main motive there is just to get his wife away from this man. I don't think he was really afraid for his safety. He just wanted to stop the affair and keep Michelle for himself. But Jonathan began seeing a psychiatrist to deal with his feelings of betrayal and depression. He was prescribed Ativan, but unfortunately that drug seemed to make him more emotionally unstable. For instance, he drove to his parents' house one day and just collapsed on their sofa in tears. And he told them that Michelle had a boyfriend and he was just terrified of losing her.
Yeah, now, Jonathan had been used to working all the time. And without work, he had way too much time on his hands. And when he wasn't writing, he learned to make furniture. So he bought an expensive saw, woodworking saw, and taught his oldest son, Alex, how to use it. While this is all going on, the marriage is still getting worse and worse. And as Jonathan became more depressed, Michelle was getting more upbeat and optimistic. She enjoyed her job at Macy's. She's making friends, and she certainly liked to get out of the house.
Well, Jonathan had tried to get her to leave the job, but she refused. And then he tried to get close to her by starting a perfume company, which he called Sempaguita, and that's the national flower of the Philippines. The plan was for him to get a sample of the flower and then duplicate the fragrance. So he wrote up a business plan and everything and hoped that he and Michelle would work together and the marriage would get better. He started experimenting with fragrances while Michelle was thinking up names for a full line of scents. But it turned out that he was on the computer all the time and he also continued to be very possessive of her. So even though they're kind of working together, they're really not, and it didn't improve the relationship. So the money is still quite a problem. And in September, the Nices put their home up for sale. Jonathan said that he wanted to move the family to Pennsylvania to be nearer to his elderly parents. But this didn't go along with what Michelle wanted at all. She was just starting to love her life in New Jersey, and she had friends and a job. She didn't want to go. So the fights got worse, with Jonathan violently destroying property at this point. Or another thing he would do that was really upsetting is he would run to his children to complain about their mother. He would tell them that their mother was mentally ill, and then he would cry to get their sympathy.
Yeah, and as we're getting into this time, their finances are getting worse and worse. Predators are calling the house almost daily, and they were being sued for all sorts of things. Dental bills was one of them. Michelle ended up talking on the phone again with DeJesus. They met at Applebee's a couple times, ended up in a motel having sex. She didn't wear her wedding ring at work, and she flirted with guys at the job. She was a beautiful woman, so it wasn't difficult for her to get attention from the opposite sex.
Sure, this is kind of all new to her. She was just a girl, and then she moved to the U.S., became a mother, stayed home all the time. So she never really had a single life and never really dated. So it was all very exciting for her. But that Thanksgiving, the family went to Jonathan's parents' house, and there was a lot of tension between Michelle and Jonathan's parents, who disapproved of the way she was dressing and the way she was behaving because Jonathan would go and complain to his parents about her. So his parents gave Michelle the cold shoulder and didn't really even speak to her unless it was necessary, like pass the potatoes. So a very awkward Thanksgiving. Not fun.
Boy, I guess.
Then over Christmas, Michelle worked extra shifts at Macy's. On December 27th, Jonathan and Michelle went to a Christmas party at the home of a friend. And Michelle had a great time doing karaoke. She liked to sing karaoke to Madonna songs. So Jonathan wanted to leave early, but Michelle wanted to stay on and party. And eventually, he demanded that they leave, and Michelle went with him, but she looked sad, and she was kind of embarrassed because he was rushing her out the door, and the party was just getting started. But on the way home, they had another big argument.
Jonathan knew that Michelle was seeing DeJesus again. It's believed that he had been following her. His attitude seemed to change, and he's talking about a future with just his children, with Michelle not included in the plans. He bought Michelle's father, who had been staying with them for some time, a return plane ticket to the Philippines.
Yeah, so these are things that just make you wonder, was he planning to do something to Michelle? Because he's getting rid of her father, and he's starting to obsess on her less and try and think about life without her. And of course, it could have been just thinking about separating, but we know that he didn't want that. But that New Year's Eve, Jonathan and Michelle threw a party for their friends and neighbors, and really seemed like the perfect couple, although they couldn't afford it at all. But someone brought along a karaoke machine, and they made it kind of a potluck. Like before, they would have catered it because they had a lot of money, but now they're trying to cut back a little bit, at least Michelle was. So Jonathan sang House of the Rising Sun on the karaoke, and Michelle sang a Madonna song. But then after midnight and the champagne toast, Michelle sang I Will Survive. And that choice of song is a little curious to me, even though it didn't seem to bother Jonathan. But that's kind of a song about breaking up with someone and being free.
Yeah.
So they scheduled a Valentine's dinner with another couple that night, also a Cancun vacation with another couple. So it seemed like things were going great, but I think this was all just a show.
Yeah, Michelle's father returned to the Philippines on January 9th, and the night before he left, he had a private conversation with his daughter. According to him, Michelle told him that she wanted to get a divorce and leave the house, but she couldn't leave her children behind. So that's a real issue for her. This was the last conversation her father had with Michelle.
Yeah, January 15th, Hopewell Township schools were closed for a snow day, so the kids were home. Michelle went shopping, and Jonathan took the children sledding. Michelle had an evening shift at Macy's, so she showered and started getting ready around 4 o'clock for a 6 o'clock shift. According to Jonathan, he and the children were in bed around 8, and once they were tucked in, he called Michelle's cell phone. There was no answer, but he held the phone up for his daughter to leave a goodnight message. Then he watched a movie with the kids in the master bed, and turned off the light for them to fall asleep around 10 p.m. Earlier, around 5 p.m., Michelle had called DeJesus to arrange to meet him that night. She told him she'd finish work at 9:30, and he said he'd get back to her around 9-ish to make plans. Michelle punched in for her shift at Macy's at 6:03 p.m., and it was a busy night. At 8:30, DeJesus called her back, and they made a plan to meet at the Applebee's. At 9:15, Michelle finished her shift and walked out to her Toyota SUV. She was caught on CCTV, still wearing her uniform. Michelle drove out of the mall, arriving at Applebee's at 9:54, and she parked her car and got into DeJesus' car. Her friend Amy called her cell and spoke with her for less than a minute, and shortly after 10, DeJesus got a room under the name Jose Pineda. And the room cost $25 for 2 hours. So that's the kind of place it was.
An upscale place.
Yeah, by the hour.
So Michelle and DeJesus, Jose, whatever, were in a second floor room. Soon after they began having sex, Jonathan called her cell. She looked at who was calling and turned her phone off. Then after they finished having sex, DeJesus called a friend. The friend was his cover story with Patricia, who had taken him back. Then Michelle and DeJesus talked for a bit. Michelle told him that she thought a female neighbor was following her and reporting back to Jonathan. She showed him a picture of the neighbor on her cell phone. Then he walked Michelle out to his car and drove her back to her SUV. When she got to her car, she told him she's going home. She rolled down the window, kissed him, and said goodnight. So it was about 12:30 in the morning when she began her drive home. It was a 13-mile ride.
So although Jonathan had been acting calm lately, he was likely very upset and angry with Michelle that night. At midnight, he tried calling her again, and when her voicemail came on, he decided to go downstairs and wait for her. He sat waiting and probably fuming for about 45 minutes. Michelle got home at about 12:45 and detectives believe that Jonathan walked to the garage entrance. As she exited her car, they began to argue right away. And when Jonathan demanded that she tell him where she'd been, she told him to fuck off and mind his own business. Then she went into the house and went upstairs to where the kids were sleeping. But the argument worsened. They were screaming at each other loud enough so it may have woken the kids even. When Michelle had enough, she called Jonathan a fucking freak. She told him that she was leaving him. Then she went into the master bedroom and packed a large black suitcase. Then she went to the bathroom to get her toiletries. But Jonathan rushed over to her, towering over her. Remember, he's 6'4", and she's barely 5 feet tall. So big size difference. They pushed each other, and a wine glass fell and broke on the floor. So detectives believe that Michelle dragged her suitcase downstairs and into the garage in her stocking feet. And this is when Jonathan Nice snapped. He realized that she was really leaving him and that he had lost control of her. And remember, control had been a big part of this relationship. As Michelle climbed into her SUV, he pulled her out so hard that he left bruises on her arm. And then he picked up a baseball bat from the wall and slammed it full force into the back of Michelle's head. And this is believed to have caused a really bad skull fracture. Michelle fell to the cement floor, hitting her head again on the running board of her vehicle. She put her hands to her face, probably just instinctually to protect herself. By now, she would have been covered in blood from her head wounds. She did manage to stand up and she tried to run away, but she was sliding in her own blood. Jonathan then caught hold of her again and threw her to the floor, grabbing her by her shoulders. It's believed that he viciously smashed her head into the cement repeatedly. The medical examiner believes that Michelle may have lived for as long as another 10 minutes, and she choked to death on her own blood. So when Jonathan came out of his rage and checked for a pulse, he knew that he had killed her. And this is when he said that he panicked, picked up her body, and put her in the driver's seat of her SUV, and threw her bloody suitcase into the back.
So at 2:15 in the morning, Jonathan opened the garage door, got into the passenger seat, and drove out of the garage. He kept the headlights off and he used a plastic ice scraper to push the accelerator and brake pedals. As he changed from reverse to drive, he lost control and veered a little bit into his front lawn. So detectives believe that he then put the driver's seat back as far as it would go and drove sitting on his wife's dead body. He drove down to a lonely creek and looked for the best spot to drive the SUV into.
So I just have to say, after reading about a lot of crimes, he was very sloppy. The cover-up was just terrible. It didn't do any good. It actually made things worse. And I guess that might have been because he was in a panic. He would try and say that he didn't plan to kill her. It was something that happened in a rage and he panicked. But whatever he did to try and cover this up was terrible. Not well done.
Well, yeah, and it, obviously he probably wasn't planning to kill her at that particular moment.
It doesn't seem like it, no.
And so when he did, he had to come up with a story.
Yes.
And albeit not a very good one.
I don't think he ever watched Forensic Files, or he would have known that this was terrible. He was doing a very lame job here. He left evidence everywhere.
Yeah. So he's only about a mile from his house when he turned and stopped at the edge of the creek. He released the brake and let the vehicle coast down into the creek. When it came to a stop, he propped up Michelle in the driver's seat, left the engine running. Then he walked back to his house, leaving footprints in the snow.
Yeah, pretty obvious.
So, duh.
So it was about 3 a.m. when Jonathan Nice got home and began the cleanup process in the garage. He used paper towels and hydrogen peroxide and then put the used towels into a plastic bag. He put one bag into a trash can and the other in a flue behind a fireplace in the basement. So I don't know how he thought that would ever work.
No, well, then he's going to compound it with some other stuff.
Oh yeah, a whole bunch. We'll go over everything. At 6 a.m., he accidentally set off the burglar alarm from the basement. And he knew that the police would have to come out and investigate, so he ran upstairs. And when he did that, he left a trail of Michelle's blood leading right to the bathroom. He put his bloody pajamas in the washing machine and hid his blood-soaked pants behind a sofa. I don't know why he didn't just put those in the wash as well. But he went back to bed with his children and pretended to have slept all night, just leaving a big mess that they're going to catch him. But that morning, Officer Michael Sherman was contacted by the Hopewell Township Police Dispatcher with the report of an accident with injuries. Maintenance workers Richard Archer and Chucky Black, who'd been working all night on a downed electrical pole, decided to meet two co-workers for breakfast early that morning. As Black drove his truck along the single-lane road in rural New Jersey, Archer, who was a hunter, scanned the snow-covered creek looking for deer. Then out of the corner of his eye, he saw the dark-colored Toyota Land Cruiser lying in the icy creek. It was just first light, and the vehicle was still running. So thinking it was probably a deer hunter staking out the creek, he didn't think too much of it, and he went on to his breakfast. An hour later, as the two returned to complete their work, Archer noticed that the Land Cruiser was still there. So he asked Black to pull over to the side of the road. He jumped out of the truck and crouched through an opening in a white picket fence there, looking down into the snow-covered creek. He saw the SUV lying at the bottom. It was in about 6 inches of icy water. The headlights weren't on. I guess John never turned them on. But he could hear the motor still running, and there was steam coming out of the engine.
So he scooted down the steep drop-off. There were tire tracks in the snow, and there was a single set of footprints coming from the passenger side of the vehicle. As he got closer, he saw fresh blood frozen in the ice next to the driver's door, and even more on the outside of the vehicle. When he looked inside, he saw Michelle Nice's body, slumped over with her eyes open. No question, she was dead. So about an hour later, Detective Daniel McCown Jr. of Hopewell Township Police Department joined Officer Sherman at the scene to help investigate. They secured the scene with red accident tape, but there were already strong suspicions of homicide. Well, yeah. There was minimal damage to the vehicle, but Michelle had severe head injuries.
Yeah, this wouldn't have been a bad accident.
No, I mean, if that was the intent, to make it look like the accident had caused her death, that wasn't going to work at all.
No, no. Well, Sherman noticed the footprints, too, that were leaving the area. Then he walked around the SUV and observed that there was blood on the running board and both the passenger and the back doors. There was also some blood smeared inside the vehicle, on the steering wheel and the front seats. One thing he did notice right away is that the driver's seat was pushed back all the way, and Michelle was tiny. There's no way that she could reach those pedals. Also, she was stocking-footed, no shoes on. So they ran the license plates through the computer. The vehicle was registered to Jonathan Nice. Because of the strong possibility of this being a homicide, the New Jersey State Police Major Crime Unit was called in. There had only been one murder in many, many years in Hopewell Township. In 1993, 64-year-old Arthur Daniels killed his estranged wife and then killed himself. In 1989, a woman's head was found at the Hopewell Golf Course. The head turned out to belong to a murder victim of the serial killer, Joel Rifkin. So how would that be, Dick, if you were out golfing one morning and you came across a woman's head?
Well, it's pretty horrifying.
Isn't it?
I'll tell you.
I can't even imagine. But my point here is that there really weren't a lot of murders going on for them to normally deal with in Hopewell Township.
No, they definitely need to have investigators that are more experienced in murders.
Yeah, plus the resources.
Right. So two officers were sent to the Nice home to interview Jonathan. They arrived at 9:13, which is just 3 hours after an officer had been there to respond to the alarm that had gone off. Two of the kids, Samantha and Trevor, answered the door. They said that neither of their parents were home. They said their mom must have gone to work early and that their dad was out taking Alex, the oldest child, to school. So a few minutes later, as officers waited in their cruiser, Jonathan pulled up in his Hummer, pretty red Hummer. He parked beside them, and they asked to go inside and talk. Nice agreed, pulled up the driveway. On his way, he closed the single garage door with a remote. So this made the officers wonder whether there's something to be hidden there.
Well, yeah, I mean, they found this dead woman in a car, and it looks like she certainly wasn't killed by that accident. And I believe one of the detectives was familiar with the restraining order and the fact that she had a lover and all that. So, of course, that's going to increase suspicions against her husband. But once in the house, Nice stood with them in the foyer, and he asked them why they were there, trying to act all casual. According to the officers, though, he looked very disheveled. His hair was uncombed, and his jeans were only partially buttoned up. As the children watched cartoons in another room, Nice spoke to the police in the dining room. An officer explained to him that his Toyota SUV had been in a crash, and they asked him who had been driving it. And Nice said it was his wife, Michelle, and then he immediately asked if she was in the hospital. He told them that Michelle had been working the 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. shift at Macy's, and then she had plans to go out with a friend. He said that she had told him she would be home by 1 a.m., but it really wasn't unusual for her to stay out later or even all night long. Which wasn't true. Even when she was with her lover, she was home every night.
Now, the officers were suspicious of Nice, and his behavior seemed unusual. For one thing, he didn't seem particularly concerned about his wife's condition. The officers read Jonathan his Miranda rights and told him that Michelle was dead. Now, he didn't ask for an attorney. Neither did he show much of a reaction to his wife's death. He went over her daily routines with him, and he told him about her extramarital affair, told him about the gardener, DeJesus. And even when 5-year-old Samantha came into the room and sat on Nice's lap, he continued talking about his wife's infidelities right in front of her. He said that the boyfriend had tried to extort them, and he had threatened the family.
So an officer went with Nice into the basement, and he allowed them to take some pictures because, remember, the burglar alarm had been activated down there. So they looked through the master bedroom, the kitchen, and the bathroom, and the laundry room as well. Once they were back in the foyer, Nice asked how he should tell his children that their mother was dead, and he started talking about getting counseling for them. And then he cried, but he seemed like he was already moving on and making plans. Usually you would be in denial. He wasn't. He seemed to accept it pretty easily. So a little bit later, Michelle's friend and neighbor, Larissa, called the house to remind Michelle about a scrapbooking workshop they had that morning. Jonathan answered the phone, and she asked him how he was doing. And he said, "Not so good. Michelle's been in a car accident." He sounded too calm, and Larissa was shocked by the whole thing. And based on his mood, she thought, well, the accident couldn't have been terribly serious. But then at 10:30 that morning, Jonathan called Larissa back and told her that Michelle was dead. He said he didn't know the details, but he was talking with a detective that afternoon. Larissa called another friend who was expected for the scrapbooking workshop, and they cried together. For the next couple of hours, they tried calling Michelle's cell phone, hoping that Jonathan was wrong. So they're in denial, but he's not. Of course, he knows what happened.
Yes, he does. So according to what investigators were able to figure out, Nice realized that he had left footprints in the snow. So he cut off the soles of his shoes. He then cut the soles into small pieces, but then hid them in a box of Christmas decorations and some other spots in the basement.
Yeah, so I guess he didn't think they were ever going to search his house.
Yeah.
I mean, the way he's hiding things.
All over the place.
Yeah.
Little here, little there.
I know. But then two detectives showed up at his house while he was in the basement, and he took about 10 minutes to come up and get to the door. He was busy with those soles of the shoes. Detective McCown was made the lead detective on the case. It was him and another detective who returned to the house to try and get a statement from Nice. And once there, a friend volunteered to care for the children while Nice was taken to the station to make a statement. Even though he had been informed of Michelle's death, no doubt about it, he acted like he didn't know it now, and he complained about not being taken to the hospital to see her. But the detectives weren't buying it, and they just kind of rolled their eyes and ignored him. He went on and on talking.
And as soon as Nice got into the unmarked police car with the detectives, the first thing he talked about was Michelle's infidelity. He told the detectives to look at the boyfriend or even the boyfriend's wife. He said that Michelle had probably been with De Jesus the night before. And then he started rambling on about his perfume company that he was going to start.
Yeah, that's a little bit odd.
So they got to the station just after 11 in the morning, and the police began taking his statement, which was typed up, and he was able to review and sign. It took him over 2 hours for him to finish. Then he went over Michelle's schedule for the previous afternoon and night. Then he said that he had fallen asleep with the kids and woke up at 6 a.m. His mother had called him to tell him that the alarm company had called her. Then he had gone back to sleep because there was a 90-minute snow delay for the schools.
Yeah, and I, for the life of me, I can't figure out why they called his mother about the alarm. But that's what happened, apparently.
Maybe she was the list of contacts.
Maybe. Maybe he didn't answer and she was the backup person.
Yeah.
But according to Nice, he saw his wife last at 4 p.m. Then he had left the house with the children as Michelle was preparing for her shift at Macy's. He had taken the kids for pizza, and then they came home and watched the movie Bruce Almighty. After the movie ended, they all fell asleep in the master bedroom. He said he did get up once in the night to use the bathroom and was concerned that his wife wasn't home, but didn't do anything about it. So detectives believed that Nice was adding to his story, because he added that one time at a restaurant, Michelle had told him that De Jesus had threatened their lives. He said that he and Michelle only had verbal arguments and they had a normal, very active sex life. But during this interview, the detectives noticed several scratches and cuts on his hands. Also, his fingernails had dirt under them. So they photographed his hands, and then they took a cheek swab for DNA.
So he's obviously consented to all this.
Yeah, didn't even get a lawyer.
Yeah. So and then Nice called his parents and told them what had happened. And his mother agreed to come to the house. But she had a 4 p.m. hair appointment. So she was going to do that first and then come over afterwards. Unbelievable.
Wow, right? That's terrible. Well, I mean, you can tell she didn't care much for her daughter-in-law.
You poor sonny of mine. I'll come over. Oh, but first I got to get my hair done.
I can't believe it. That is disgusting and ridiculous. So by noon that day, detectives were absolutely certain that Michelle had been murdered. Police cars closed off the road leading to the creek. There was a helicopter overhead taking pictures. So this was a very expansive crime scene, which had to be gone over very closely. And of course, the footprints were very important as evidence. Michelle had an ice scraper between her legs, and her suitcase was lying on the back seat. It had blood on it. Michelle's friend Amy had spoken to Michelle about 10 p.m. the night before, and she thought that Michelle was planning to meet up with her lover after work. She talked about Michelle's relationship with Jonathan, telling them that Michelle complained that they argued daily. But she never said that he had hit her or otherwise gotten physical, so Amy wasn't aware of any previous physical abuse. But she knew that Michelle was unhappy.
By the time Michelle's body could be removed from the vehicle, it had completely frozen. She had some hair and some fibers clenched in her left hand, and these brutal head injuries. But there was no damage to the windshield or the dashboard of the car.
Right, so where would she have injured her head?
Exactly.
So her friend Larissa came back to the Nice house later that day after she met with the police, and she told Jonathan that she would take the children back to her house for dinner and comfort them because, you know, they knew her, they were comfortable with her. And he seemed thankful for that offer. But then, when Larissa headed to the garage to get Samantha's coat and boots, she said that Jonathan ran up and blocked the door and gave her this really strange look just staring at her. It was so creepy, plus she'd lost her friend, she just started to cry and apologize to him. But she was really afraid of what he might do. I mean, what if she had come across some blood? Would he have killed her to cover it up?
Yeah.
So she was really afraid of him at this point.
At 6:15 that evening, the medical examiner arrived at the crime scene. The fire department had set up spotlights around the vehicle, and within minutes, the medical examiner determined that Michelle had died by homicide. The accident certainly looked staged. After her body was removed, the SUV was taken to the New Jersey State Police facility.
Well, detectives believed that Michelle had been killed at her home. And there had to be evidence there, right?
Had to be.
But when the police arrived at the Nice home with a warrant, that's when he finally called an attorney. So Jonathan gathered up some clothing for himself and the children as an officer followed him and kept an eye on him. When he went to go into the bathroom, the door was locked, so he went into the master bedroom and got a key and returned to unlock that bathroom door. As soon as the officer entered, he stepped on some broken glass. Nice said his kids had been in there earlier and broke a glass. He'd locked the door so they wouldn't go in and step on it, he said. Which I guess is fairly believable, but this was a wine glass. And I don't know how many kids have wine glasses. Unless it was sitting there and they knocked it. I mean, it's feasible.
I mean, that's probably the most plausible story that he's told.
That's true. Compared to the other ones, that one is just hunky-dory.
So Jonathan and his parents arrived at Larissa's house around 9:30 to pick up the kids. He said he was taking them to Collegeville to stay with his parents. But before he left, he took Larissa and her husband aside. He told them that Michelle had had a wild side. Then he told them about her affair with the gardener. He said that she was bipolar, and she liked to have sex all the time. He said that Michelle had been with the guy the previous night. So Larissa's pretty confused and upset by this. Why was he tearing down her friend right after she had died in an accident? But as she thought about it, she realized that he was already working to show himself in the best light and point suspicions at other people.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's the way I'd take it.
Sure.
So the day after Michelle was killed, Jonathan had not made any attempt yet to notify her family in the Philippines. They only learned of her death after a Filipino friend of hers read an article in the Trenton Times, and he called a family member in the Philippines who drove right over to the Riviera's home. Michelle's father said that he was told she died in an accident. So he called Jonathan and asked what had happened, and Jonathan told him, well, she died in a car accident. Michelle's father was suspicious, though. Remember, he'd lived with them for several months and knew they were fighting and that his daughter wanted a divorce. He asked Jonathan questions, but he didn't get any answers, really. His first thought was that maybe Jonathan had done something to Michelle's car to cause her to have an accident. And I could understand having that thought.
Sure. No, he's like you said, he's been witness to some heated arguments.
Absolutely.
So he knows what the relationship was like.
Well, and the main thing is Michelle wanted to leave him, and he didn't want her to leave. That's basically what it boils down to.
Correct. So that same day, Michelle's autopsy was performed. Before doing the exam, her body was taken to a hospital and x-rayed for any broken bones. Nothing was fractured other than her skull. There was some blood and tears in her stockings, which seemed to indicate she had been walking or running in the blood. When her face and head were examined, there was a great deal of blood over her skin and clothing. There were three lacerations to her forehead that were so deep that the skull could be visualized.
Ugh, that's just awful. Can you imagine how much blood would come from that?
No kidding. This injury was believed to have been done with a baseball bat, and her entire body was covered in bruises and contusions. She had defensive injuries on her hands. In her brain, there was hemorrhaging from blunt force trauma, and it appeared that she did not die quickly. There was bloody froth in her lungs, which indicated she had been breathing for several minutes after her brain and skull were severely injured. The completed postmortem report said that Michelle had died of blunt force injuries to her head, with a fractured skull and intracranial bleeding. Manner of death was homicide.
So Michelle's lover, De Jesus, was located by the police at an apartment building in nearby Cranberry. His common-law wife answered the apartment door, and De Jesus was there just sitting on the couch. Interestingly, he hired an attorney before going with the police for an interview. And that's funny because a week or two ago we were talking about the more educated people are, the more likely they are to ask for an attorney. But we've got a doctor here who didn't ask for an attorney and a gardener who did.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit unusual. Although he's had some run-ins with the police, so I think he was a little more street smart for sure.
Yeah, that's probably an issue.
Yeah. So he said that he and Michelle had been back together for a couple of months, and he easily admitted that he had been with her Thursday night, which was the night that She was killed. After having sex at their hotel, he drove her back to her car and kissed her goodnight, he said, and this was around 12:30. Then he drove to a diner and had two Heinekens. Then, around 1:30 a.m., he drove home, where Patricia and their daughter were sleeping. And as he was getting undressed for bed, Patricia woke up and ordered him to sleep on the couch because he'd been drinking, and when he drank, he usually snored really badly. So according to De Jesus, Michelle had told him before that her husband had chained her against the bed and beat her. He said that Michelle was afraid of Jonathan because of his temper and because he was so much bigger. So De Jesus was allowed to leave after he signed his statement.
Now, the only damage noted on Michelle's SUV was a scraped bumper that was bent inward a little bit. There were some minor scratches and dents, but these were felt to be expected in a car that had over 100,000 miles on it. After taking photographs, the detectives collected 20 items as evidence. These included the large bloodstained suitcase, a denim jacket, two ice scrapers, two pairs of high heels, Michelle's purse, her $1,000 watch, and three cell phones.
Well, we know she had at least two. She had one for her lover and then her regular one. But on the inside of the suitcase, it looked like Michelle had really packed in a hurry. While detectives examined the items, more detectives were at the Nice home doing their search. When they arrived, they found the Nice's dog, ferret, and a bird in the freezing cold basement. Jonathan had just left them behind. So, if you don't think he's an asshole already, now you do, right?
You got it.
Animal control had to come in and take custody of the animals. And then the police spent 3 days searching the house. When they got to the basement, they immediately saw blood on the door jamb and on the floor. There were also blood-colored spots on the snowblower and on a recycling bin. They noticed also some fresh paint on specific areas of the basement floor, as if someone was trying to paint over and cover something up.
In the garage, there was blood on the door frame, and it looked like the floor had been washed. There was a baseball bat on a shelving unit as well, and the bat had some dark stains on it. There was a plastic bag and a blue garbage bin, and the bag had many blood-soaked paper towels inside it. On the garage floor, there were more bloody paper towels, and in another recycling bin, there was a frozen man's sock with blood and hair on it. So he's done a really good cleanup, hasn't he?
It's just amazing to me.
Upstairs in the living room, investigators found a soaking wet pair of men's pajama bottoms stuffed behind the sofa. And the washing machine in the laundry room had reddish-brown water in it.
So, just terrible.
I guess.
At 9 p.m. on Saturday, a detective called Jonathan at his parents' house and asked him to return for another interview. There was a snowstorm in the area that day, though, so they agreed that he could come at 9 a.m. the next morning. But just in case, they did ask the Collegeville PD to put him under 24-hour surveillance until he left for New Jersey. But Jonathan showed up right on time the next day. For several minutes, the interviewing detective went over all the evidence they had against him, which was just overwhelming. And they said, "We believe that you killed your wife." Jonathan said they were looking at the wrong person. He pointed the blame again to De Jesus and his wife. He again mentioned Michelle's infidelity and the alleged extortion attempt, which the police didn't believe was real either.
No.
He said, well, maybe he was being framed by De Jesus. And the detectives just thought that was really ridiculous and made no sense. They really kind of laughed at that one. Can you imagine how that would have worked?
No kidding. Now, Jonathan said he wanted to go home and think about what he was going to say to be more helpful. and the detective said, nah, you're not going to do that.
No.
Now, once he realized that the evidence against him was pretty overwhelming, Jonathan tried to make a deal. He said he would provide a statement which implicated him in Michelle's death if he would only have to serve a short time in jail so he could be with his children again. Now, this was pretty much laughed off by the interrogators.
Well, yeah, he doesn't seem to know how law enforcement or justice works. You don't make a deal.
No. Then he denied killing her again.
Yeah.
Then his attorney showed up, but Jonathan said he didn't want to talk to him. He asked if Michelle had been with her lover that night, and when they told him that she had, Nice lost control of his emotions. He cried, almost on the verge of hyperventilating, and he said, "I didn't mean to kill her."
So is he more upset about her cheating on him or killing her? It's hard to say, isn't it?
It's certainly hard to say.
But by noon that day, Jonathan had given the police his version of Michelle's murder and how he had tried to stage it as a car accident. He claimed to have been acting in self-defense after Michelle came at him with a stiletto or a knife. After putting her body into her car, he'd driven to the creek and over the edge into the water, and he admitted that he tried to clean up the blood with paper towels and peroxide. But Jonathan was arrested then for first-degree murder of his wife. And it's funny because then he congratulated the detectives for their diligent work, and he called his arrest a quick conclusion. The press was given a copy of the state's probable cause complaint, and Nice's bail was set at $2 million cash. But he hired prominent defense attorney Robin Lord, and she managed to get him released on $1.7 million bail. His trial began in June 2005, and in his version of events, Michelle attacked him with a knife, and he was acting in self-defense. A search was done of the entire neighborhood, including storm drains, and a knife was never found. His attorney was quite dramatic, and at one point, she unpacked the suitcase filled with Michelle's clothing, one item at a time, taking out a piece of lingerie here, a bra there, some Victoria's Secret panties, and this seemed just like an attempt to shame the victim, which it happens, right?
Oh, it does. So his attorney was a fervid supporter of her client. In a 2005 interview with the New York Times, she said if he really wanted to kill his wife, he could have designed a drug to do it.
So I don't understand that logic.
What the hell is that?
Yeah. But her defense was pretty effective. She got the judge to give the option of convicting Nice on the lesser charge of passion, provocation, manslaughter. And he was convicted on that charge and given a pretty short sentence. In 2007, he filed for an appeal based on the judge supposedly demeaning his attorney. But this was a new attorney filing for this appeal. But this new attorney was then arrested and charged for taking over a prostitution ring after the arrest of a client who'd been a pimp. So, Nice's attorney pled guilty and served probation. But he was later given a life sentence for running a crime syndicate that was involved in cocaine trafficking, bribery, fraud, and even the murder of a witness. So after all this and getting a new attorney, Nice's appeal was denied. And his children, at this time, they had gone to live with Jonathan's brother in Pennsylvania.
What happened to the first attorney? She just resigned?
Well, after getting him off for getting his light sentence, she wasn't his attorney anymore.
And he didn't go back to her to say, I need you to represent me.
Yeah, he didn't. And maybe it was just because she was expensive. She was pretty good at what she did.
Well, I think she did a good job for him.
Absolutely. It's just crazy. In 2012, Nice published a book, Under Color of Law, and in that he described his run-ins with the criminal justice system, and he maintained his innocence. The subtitle of the book reads, The Deliberate Conviction of an Innocent Man and the Destruction of a Family. So you can kind of see where that's leaning.
So Nice was released from prison after having served 5 years of his 8-year sentence. At age 70 and living in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, he was charged with wire fraud and interstate shipment of misbranded animal drugs. The prosecutor claimed that Nice was responsible for a scheme to defraud pet owners of money by claiming to sell canine cancer-curing medications. Investors claimed that Nice began his pet meds scam after his release from prison. He marketed the drugs under the names Temexel and Naturazone and scammed pet owners for hundreds of thousands of dollars. He claimed these drugs would cure cancer, but in reality, they were just ingredients, useless, mixed up by Nice himself.
So yeah, once I learned of this, I thought he probably was pretty scammy in his other business as well. Once a scammer, always a scammer, it seems.
Yeah.
But one thing he did was he charged some people for access to clinical trials that he claimed were showing encouraging results. One poor woman gave him $5,000 in this desperate attempt to save her dog. He also promoted these drugs by emails and phone calls to owners of terminally ill dogs. And these drugs were not FDA approved, of course. but he also claimed that they were funded in part by the FDA. So if convicted on this, he faces a maximum possible sentence of 32 years in prison and a fine of up to $1.25 million. So the latest I could find on this was earlier this year, and he hadn't had his trial yet.
But he will.
Absolutely, unless he pleads guilty, which he might have to because the evidence is pretty heavy on this as well.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. He sounds like a piece of work.
Oh, absolutely. And I just feel so bad for her family back in the Philippines.
Yeah.
They never even met their grandchildren, except the father who came to stay with them. So our sources include an article from CEO to wife killer to snake oil salesman from the Princeton Info, February 2020. A book titled Never Leave Me by John Glatt. The New Jersey Court Archives. Thank you to Tristan Capel for our music. If you enjoy listening to our shows, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen.
So if you visit our website, tygrabber.com, you'll find a shopping page where you can buy some brewery merchandise. This time of year, it's time for Christmas shopping and stuff, and you're probably not going out to the malls, probably doing more online shopping. And what better place to do online shopping than Tygrabber?
Well, yeah, better than Amazon. They have enough money.
Yeah.
Why not support the show?
We have tanks, tees, we have warm, soft hoodies for you as the cooler weather moves in. And now we also have cloth masks to keep you safe and allow you to declare your love for TCB in public.
Great. All right. Why don't we go ahead with feedback?
Okay. So feedback. I found this great letter from Robin in Ireland. It's an email, not a voicemail. And it's a lengthy letter with several things to talk about. So I just did this one email.
So we're devoting feedback to her letter.
This is your feedback, Robin.
Okay.
So she says, "Hi, Jill and Dick. Greetings from Ireland. I hope you're both doing well during the pandemic and wanted to thank you for continuing to bring an interesting case to your listeners every Tuesday. It's been a very welcome distraction from all the world chaos. I love how you guys are always incredibly respectful towards the victims of these awful crimes and really feel like you bring an empathetic awareness to how the victims were wronged."
Well, that's really nice. Thank you, Robin.
Very much. So I have a case suggestion, which is a topic that you guys don't tend to cover, but I would really love to get your perspective on cults. I'm really interested in the psychology of how cult leaders can totally manipulate their followers into abandoning their best interests, and would love to hear you guys' perspective on a case such as the Jonestown Massacre. Then another case I'd love to hear you guys explore, although I'm not sure if it really counts as a crime, is the Donner Party from the 1800s. And everyone knows that story. The wagon settlers were snowbound in the Rocky Mountains for months without food and resorted in some cases to cannibalism. I don't know a lot about the case, but think it's really interesting and know there's a bit of literature out there on it.
So you looked that up to see if it was illegal to eat a human body.
I did.
So if anyone checks your internet history, they might be suspicious.
I hope you don't disappear anytime soon.
Yeah.
Finally, and sorry my letter is so long, I really loved the few episodes you did on the untrue crimes in movies. Listening to a podcast about your favorite films as if they were real is a hoot. And I would love to hear you guys discuss some more films like Fargo, Absolute Power, The Shining, or any other movie you guys like.
Well, we love Fargo. I mean, I'm constantly quoting Fargo.
You are.
What's Absolute Power?
That's
Sounds familiar.
Travolta movie. Presidency and stuff like that.
Oh, so that's not Clint Eastwood.
No.
Okay.
I don't think.
All right. The Shining could be interesting as well.
Could be.
Hopefully we'll do something like that for Christmas.
And just one more question. After covering so many cases, many of which the victim has fallen for the charms of their killer, particularly involving husbands and wives, do you guys have any tips for us single gals out here to avoid potentially accidentally shacking up with a killer? Ha ha. That's 80% a joke and 20% really asking. Okay, Robin. Keep up the great work. I look forward to listening to you every week. You bring something special and unique to the true crime podcast scene. Robin.
Very nice. Thank you.
So that's a lengthy letter.
Yeah, but nice.
Oh, it's a great letter.
Mm-hmm.
So we did do an episode on the Heaven's Gate cult. That was in December of 2017. We haven't done any other episodes on cults.
Yeah, well, I was wondering about Jonestown. That's an interesting thing to talk about.
That could be.
Super heartbreaking, though.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So what about the Donner Party, Dick? I mean, according to the literature, they only ate the people who had died. So it wasn't considered a crime?
Well, at the time, it was not considered a crime. Certainly, if they had killed the person before eating them, that's a crime.
Sure. How do you prove that, though?
Well, these days, cannibalism is considered desecration of a corpse, which is a criminal offense.
Yeah, but I wonder if you're with a dead body and you're starving to death.
Well, I'm sure there's all sorts
of
loopholes and allowances, but basically...
Good to know.
Good to know. And yes, we are hoping to do some more untrue crime movies, and Fargo certainly would be at the top or near the top of our list.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't beat Frances McDormand, can you?
No. You betcha.
No siree.
Now, we're probably not the ones to give out dating advice.
Well, it's not really dating advice. It's more like a safety issue.
And I found a site called Psychopaths in Love. No, don't laugh.
I'm not. Sorry. Okay.
It had some nice advice. And I'm just going to read a little bit from the site. And this is just food for thought, basically. Nobody thinks that I want to be in an unhappy relationship with a person who is only out to dominate and humiliate me and will use me for sex and entertainment along the way. Ideally, he'll be someone who has no respect for me and who will manipulate me into losing all respect for myself. He must be able to take control of me so he can hurt me deeply and repeatedly and yet keep me running back for more with just a few kind words or a worn-out promise. I want him to be a pathological liar, and I want to be let down in every way. I want to give up all the dreams I ever had for myself in exchange for a few stale crumbs of false affection. I want to be kept on emotional tenterhooks, in constant turmoil as I wonder where I stand with him, what I'm doing wrong, how can I make him happy, where he really is right now, and what will happen tomorrow. I want someone who will waste my time while he abuses me and diminishes me until I don't have the strength to stand up and walk away, and I don't even want to. I want to learn to blame myself for all this, and I want someone who can make me believe this is love.
So this is what you don't want?
This is obviously what you're not looking for. And if you're involved in a relationship and this is some of the stuff you're running into, get out of it.
Well, Dick, that's easy to say.
I know it's easy to say.
This usually happens incrementally. So it's usually not all at once this happens. They seem nice. You get drawn in. So I think the basic thing is just to, it sounds corny, but love yourself and respect yourself enough not to let anyone treat you badly from the beginning before it's too late.
Right. You can look at ways of doing this. Like, what do you want out of a relationship? What are you looking for?
Right. So have that in mind or even written down before you, because your heart, lust, all that can get in the way of making correct decisions.
Oh, absolutely.
Not that I have any experience with that. So you said setting boundaries was listed as an important thing. And I guess that's more about the self-respect and what you will tolerate.
Exactly.
Which is kind of like Tina Fey's old saying, a deal breaker. Write down some things that are deal breakers and don't tolerate them no matter what.
And then your suggestion, which is very apt, do a background check.
Yeah. There are plenty of sites on the internet. We didn't want to endorse just one. But I'm a big proponent of the background check.
Yeah.
If you meet someone through friends and you know where they work, that's different. You can kind of see how it goes. But especially with internet dating, I would absolutely do a background check. And of course, meet them in public and all those other tips we've heard before.
Yes, all that.
Yeah, so good luck, Robin. Find yourself a great partner.
And that's it for feedback.
All right, I enjoyed that one.
Me too. I know it was a long letter. But it was fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I never would have found Psychopaths and Love website if I didn't have this letter.
Yes. Well, thank you everyone for listening. And we're going to see you next week at the Quiet End.
You bet. I'll save you a seat. Come on down.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.